First, Congress continues its investigation into the violent attack on the Capitol on January 6th with multiple hearings and witnesses from various law enforcement agencies. And senators are getting their first cracks at President Biden's coronavirus relief and economic recovery bill. It's the week in Washington where we take a closer look at some of the top stories in national politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about what different law enforcement groups knew going into January 6th, how they responded, how quickly they responded? Have you been following these hearings? What has stood out to you? What do you want to know more about? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Scott Wong is a senior staff writer at The Hill covering House leadership. Scott, welcome back to Central Time.
Rob, good to be with you.
I know you're following both chambers as they review January 6th. Scott, who are we hearing from this week?
Well, today we had hearings in both the House and the Senate concurrently on the January 6th attacks on the Capitol. And as you just heard, we had Major General William Walker testify from the D.C. National Guard. He's the top official for the National Guard in Washington, D.C., who testified that there was a frantic call that came in from the Capitol Police Chief on January 6th, and that it took more than 3 hours, 3 hours and 19 minutes to be exact, before he got approval from top Pentagon officials who needed to sign off on sending the National Guard to the Capitol, even though there were dozens of his troops on buses ready to go engage in the battle that was already underway in the Capitol. He needed that sign off, and it took more than 3 hours. And as we know now, there were dozens and dozens of injuries to Capitol police officers during that time. And of course, five people died in the fighting and some of the related incidents. So we are learning more and more details as we speak, more and more details. The pieces are slowly falling into place. And then on the House side of things, Rob, we heard from the Capitol Police Chief, the acting Capitol Police Chief, Pittman, who testified a more urgent threat to the Capitol. She told lawmakers today that they are on high alert this week because of information and intelligence they're getting that a militia group known as the Three Percenters is looking to breach the Capitol again as soon as tomorrow, March 4th. March 4th is significant in the QAnon conspiracy theory because that's the day when they believe, QAnon believers, that former President Trump will be inaugurated again. Of course, we know that's not going to happen, but in this conspiracy theory, this is what they think is going to happen. There's a concern among lawmakers and law enforcement that there could be another attempt to breach the Capitol sometime tomorrow.
Let's give a listen to General William Walker, commander of the D.C. National Guard, talking about the urgency of the call he got that you mentioned. Here's a listen.
At 1:49 p.m., I received a frantic call from then Chief of United States Capitol Police, Stephen Sun, where he informed me that the security perimeter of the United States Capitol had been breached by hostile rioters. Chief Sun, his voice cracking with emotion, indicated that there was a dire emergency at the Capitol, and he requested the immediate assistance of as many available National Guardsmen that I could muster.
And that open questions remain about that timeline. I understand some in the Pentagon have disputed that timeline, the three-hour delay. What does that open up about who members of Congress want to hear from next to try to get to the bottom of that, Scott?
Well, that's exactly right. Pentagon officials are refuting General Walker's account, which is something you don't necessarily see too often in the chain of command, where you have a subordinate officer questioning the actions of the higher ups. But their argument from the top of Pentagon officials, their argument was that they had approved the request for National Guard aid quickly in about an hour's time, which doesn't match up with Walker's account. They also point out that they had made the National Guard available to Capitol Police and other law enforcement in the days in advance of the January 6th attack, but were turned down. So there's a lot of contradictions and all of these statements from various officials, even within the Pentagon itself. Now, I think it's interesting that Walker feels empowered to criticize some of his former bosses because a lot of those people are no longer at the Pentagon anymore. They served under President Trump. There's a new team in place now serving under President Biden. And so Walker may feel a little bit more liberated to criticize the top brass at the Pentagon than he would had some of those individuals remained in place.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Joe is with us in Milwaukee. Joe, hello. Joe, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah, what did you want to say, Joe?
I wanted to say that in his last, month in office, Trump fired people in the Pentagon and put in, completely bizarre cronies to head the, very powerful seats at the Pentagon. And these people were in the decision-making chain, as was apparently the brother of, I forget the name, Flynn, General Flynn. And I'm not really hearing anybody talking about, these people's complicity in this lack of decision making at this critical time.
Joe, thanks for the call. And Scott, yeah, the president had dismissed his defense secretary. There was an acting defense secretary in place, and in many ways at the top of this chain of command. What are people looking at the roles that some of those late appointees may have made on January 6th and in the run up to it?
Certainly. We heard from both Democratic and Republican senators today that they want to hear from some of these people who were in decision-making roles at the Pentagon, acting Secretary of Defense at the time, Christopher Miller, as well as Army Secretary Ryan McCarthy, both Trump officials. For Miller, he served after Mark Esper and very late in the game in terms of the Trump presidency. And so these are additional people that members of Congress of both parties want to haul before their committees and hear directly from their mouths what had happened and what had transpired in those three hours and 20 minutes after that frantic call was made by the Capitol Police Chief.
Thanks for the call, Joe. We're talking to Scott Wong from The Hill, looking at the top stories in national politics this week. Scott, Congress also heard from FBI Director Christopher Wray. He talked about the intelligence the FBI did and didn't have leading up to January 6th and about claims, including from some on the Senate floor, misleading claims on who was involved in that Capitol riot. What were some of the key things we heard from the FBI director?
Well, number one, that he addressed some of the concerns about the security and intelligence breakdowns that had to do with the FBI Norfolk office in Virginia. This is the office that sent out a bulletin the night before the attack, warning of potential violence at the Capitol on January 6th. They were picking up chatter in some of those circles of that there was going to be war at the Capitol, if you remember. And the FBI in previous weeks had been faulted for merely sending an email in the dead of night that apparently didn't get picked up by any of the associated law enforcement agencies. But Director Christopher Wray pushed back during a Senate hearing earlier this week, saying the FBI actually had communicated that message to its law enforcement partners in three different ways: on email, through their law enforcement portal, which is connected to all the various agencies, something that was set up in the wake of 9/11 when there were complaints that there wasn't communication between the agencies. And also, he says they followed up by phone calls. So at some point along the line, the ball was dropped. It's still unclear who exactly dropped the ball, but according to Wray, they reached out and sent that message, a warning of a potential violence, three different ways. He also made clear that this was, he's not mincing words, he's calling this domestic terror. And so he wanted to be clear. I know there was some dispute about what exactly you call this attack, since it was carried out and perpetrated by Americans. He made clear, number one, that this was a domestic terrorist attack intended to cause harm or to intimidate members of Congress, in the process of carrying out their democratic duties. And he also made clear that he was questioned directly of whether, you know, Antifa was behind this. He made clear that, that did not appear to be the case at all. There's some dispute. Republicans certainly are trying to muddy the waters in that regard. But I think he was very clear that the violence, the most heinous acts were carried out by some of these militia groups. A lot of them are right wing militia groups, and certainly there appeared to be, in many cases, this was a coordinated attempt, and they have a lot of evidence pointing to that as well. So those were some of the key points that we heard from Director Ray.
We're talking to Scott Wong, senior staff writer at The Hill. It's the week in Washington. We're talking about more congressional hearings looking at January 6th and coming up, the U.S. Senate now taking up the COVID relief and economic recovery bill. You can join in at 800-642-1234. The bill passed the House. It is before the Senate now. The minimum wage increase is out of it for now. Do you think Democrats should push to try to bring it back through potentially by Senate standards, extreme measures, or are you okay with that not being in there? Dialing back some of the checks, lowering the threshold where the checks' direct payments to people go down, some efforts to slow things down by Republicans in the Senate. What do you think? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Scott Wong, senior staff writer at The Hill. It's our look at the top stories in national politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234 as we turn to the new COVID-19 economic relief package now before the Senate. Join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Okay, Scott, this thing is through the House on the road to this reconciliation procedure that just requires a majority or 50 plus a vice president in this case. But some changes already, including that threshold for who gets direct payments. What is changing now in the Senate?
Yeah, Rob, that was the big development today, was this deal between Joe Biden and the Senate Democrats. They tweaked the threshold, the income level requirements to qualify for these $1,400 stimulus checks. The change is that it's now $75,000 per individuals per year, or for couples, $150,000 per year. Those people who make that salary will still receive the full $1,400 stimulus check. There's also, they changed the way that the money is phased out. So people who make now $80,000 per year, anything above $80,000 per year, they will not be receiving a check. The House bill had put that number up at $100,000 salary per year. And so it restricts the amount of people who will be eligible to receive a stimulus check. That's the bottom line. Progressives obviously had wanted the most amount of people to get these checks. They are saying that they're disappointed. People like, Pramila Jayapal and Mark Pocan, progressive leaders, they are saying they're disappointed, but it doesn't look like it's going to be a deal breaker. It doesn't look like, they're going to lose Democratic votes because of some of these tweaks. And so the bottom line is Democrats know that they want to get this victory. They want to hand Joe Biden the first legislative victory of his presidency. They understand that the need is great. They understand they want to push this money out into the community. And so, at the end of the day, they will get there. We're still winding through this legislative process. And right now we're just at the start of it in the Senate. It's going to be a number of days where it's going to work its way through the amendment process in the Senate. And then next week, they're going to kick it back over to the House, where I am right now, and they'll have to take it up once again in the House before they send it on to Joe Biden's desk.
Let's bring on a caller on this at 800-642-1234. Kevin is with us in northern Wisconsin. Kevin, hello.
Hey, how you doing? Yeah, just, you know, as far as the stimulus checks, you know, maybe there can be changes on as far as the income limits. But, you know, when you're making $20,000-$30,000 a year, okay, say you're say you need tires for your vehicle, okay, or you got another repair. I mean, that stuff's really expensive nowadays. Or say your refrigerator goes out on you, okay, you got $1,000 in the bank or with you to take care of that. You know what's wrong? I don't think there's anything wrong with it. So, because I'm on a fixed income and I've received the stimulus checks, and I was quite accustomed to living on a fixed income. And but it's nice to have a couple extra dollars in the bank and on my person.
Kevin, thanks a lot for calling in. And Scott, we've heard a lot from callers, some saying, yes, this stimulus check is a lifesaver for me, or at least a big difference maker. Some people maybe hovering around that level where people are saying that's where the threshold should be, saying, yeah, I don't really need the check. It seems like there's a lot of general agreement that checks for at least some Americans might be a good idea. It's just a matter of where that threshold is.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, Democrats realize that this is just a Band-Aid, and that, you know, there are so many millions of Americans who are impacted by the COVID crisis. You know, here we are a year later, and Congress has already passed, you know, three big packages. Here's yet another package, and this one will rival that initial package they did at the start of the crisis last year. But you know, the talk in Democratic circles right now is that this is just the start, and the next step after they pass this COVID bill next week will be some kind of jobs bill. So, you know, first they're throwing aid at the problem in terms of, you know, testing and vaccines and monies for school and monies for state and local governments, as well as these checks for people and unemployment insurance money. And then the next step after that will be some kind of jobs bill. And the thing that people are most talking about up here is infrastructure. And so I think after the COVID relief bill, you're going to see this pivot towards infrastructure, and there's going to be a whole nother debate over that, specifically whether it can be a bipartisan, you know, pursuit, or if, again, you know, it's going to be something like we're seeing with this COVID package, which is very partisan. It's going to pass basically on party lines. Not a single Republican in the House supported it last week. We are anticipating either zero or perhaps one Republican could endorse it in the Senate. Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, who said today she's still on the fence. You know, but that has been the criticism of Republicans, is that there's not enough of reaching across the aisle to get Republicans on board this thing. That'll be a big question for the infrastructure package in the next round, whether or not that will be something that will be bipartisan.
Let's go back to our callers. Steve is with us in Stevens Point. Steve, hello.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. If you could you comment on why this bill is being called a COVID relief bill when 90% of it has nothing to do with COVID relief? Only 10% of this bill goes directly to COVID relief. You would get a lot more bipartisan support if this bill wasn't quite structured the way it is. If you could comment on that, I'd certainly appreciate it, and I'd like to hear what you have to say.
Steve, thanks a lot for the call. This is another criticism from Republicans in particular. Some of this is directly for vaccines and treating disease. Some of it's for economic relief related to COVID, and then it kind of gets blurry from there. Where do you see the line drawn there, Scott?
Yeah, I'm not sure where the caller's getting the 90% percent versus 10% number. You know, what Democrats have said, this is going to focus on specific things having to do with COVID, meaning vaccine, more money for vaccines, more money for testing, also things like, you know, and then peripheral things like how to get kids back in schools, which is indirectly related to COVID, in terms of air filtration systems, increasing the you know, the air quality in classrooms. They're saying that is all related to COVID. You have the, as we mentioned before, the direct checks and the stimulus payments. You have they are keeping in the Senate bill the $400 per week in enhanced unemployment benefits. It looks like the Senate wants to keep those enhanced benefits through the month of August. And so that is very similar to what we saw in the House. There had been some discussion that they were going to try to pare that back, but it looks like they're going to be able to preserve it at that level. The big Republican criticism had been focused on this idea of some transportation projects, specifically in New York, and then the one I'm more familiar with coming from the San Francisco Bay Area, which is the BART train extension to San Jose. There had been $100 million set aside or earmarked for that. Republicans have said that was, that was a Nancy Pelosi earmark that was inserted in this bill. Apparently, that has been stripped out of it after the Republican criticism. Republicans are celebrating that move, as well as a stripping out of another transportation project in New York. So there is some valid criticism that there were some extraneous issues in there. But in terms of the grand scheme of things, those were very, very minor dollar figures compared to the nearly $2 trillion package that is this coronavirus relief bill.
And it looks like, Scott, the 10% is roughly the public health part of this, the vaccines and PPE and things like this, that are, of course, is a COVID economic relief package mainly. So I think that's where that 10% is out there.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
That's all the time we have, Scott. Thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Oh, sure. Anytime, Rob. Thank you.
That's Scott Wong. He covers House leadership as a senior staff writer at The Hill. We talked to him today for a look at the week in Washington, looking at the latest developments around the Senate and President Biden's COVID bill.